Jim Angel has been watching Illinois' weather and climate for more than 20 years as our state climatologist. During that time, the climate has changed, and it's going to change at an even greater rate going forward. Here he is speaking at the U of I's Prairie Research Institute.
If you look at Illinois, we've warmed by about 1.5–2 degrees over the last century. To me, more importantly, is that we've actually gotten about 10% wetter. So we're not only wetter, but we're also getting more of the heavy rainfall events, and so that's leading to more flooding.
Jim's retiring after serving in his role for 21 years, and he joins us one more time to talk Illinois weather, climate, and take a look back at his career. Do you have questions for him? Give us a call at 1-800-222-9455. Plus, there are so many kinds of holiday gifts, but there's no substitute for a good book. We'll bring on some Illinois librarians with their suggestions for every kind of reader. That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay tuned. We'll get started after the latest news. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Coming up later this hour, the University of Illinois has fired a tenured professor over fake data he used in a federal grant application. Plus, if you still haven't finished your holiday shopping, or if you're just looking for something good to read over the holidays, we're going to give you some book recommendations from a few Illinois experts. But first, over the last 20 years in Illinois, we've had natural disasters like tornadoes, flooding. We've also had weather events like El Nino back in the 90s. And of course, as we look ahead, we know that Illinois will feel and is feeling the effects of climate change in a big way. I was in Chicago yesterday. It was 50 degrees. Throughout all of this, Jim Angel has been our state's climatologist. He's served in that role since 1997. He's been an important voice on all things Illinois climate. Lately, you may have heard him here or also on your local public radio station. When the federal government's National Climate Assessment Report came out, he wrote the Midwest chapter of that report. And we know now that the Midwest is facing the biggest temperature change of any other region in the country. This month, Jim officially retires after 21 years as our state's climatologist. So we thought we'd invite him back on the 21st one more time. We've been taking your questions on social media. We'll get to those, but you can continue to tweet your questions or thanks to Jim. And as always, you can give us a call, too. Our phone number is 1-800-222-9455. That's 1-800-222-9455. Jim Angel, welcome back to the 21st.
Yes, thanks for having me.
So I mentioned that you have been the state climatologist since 1997, but you've actually been studying Illinois' climate since 1984.
That's right. Yes, I've been at the Illinois State Water Survey since 1984. And at the time, the State Water Survey was a state agency, but it was always on the campus of the university. So I was always a University of Illinois employee. And so we did a lot of research projects on droughts and floods and heat waves and things like that, even back into the 1980s.
I want to start with even before that, though, and ask you what first interested you in the weather. Why did you decide to go into meteorology?
Well, I think it goes all the way back to my childhood. My grandparents were farmers, so obviously they're very sensitive to weather conditions and always talking about the weather. And my grandpas had their own theories on weather. Of course, this was before the Weather Channel or the internet or cell phones or anything like that. So you pretty much had to look at what was going on around you to see, to make your own forecast. So,
or the almanac.
Yeah, the almanac, too. Yes, they like that one. So at a very early age. And then I found out later that you could actually make a career out of doing that kind of stuff. So I went to school at the University of Missouri, got a bachelor's and master's degree, and then got my first job here in 1984, and that's where I've stayed. So ever since then, we've been here, and I got my PhD here at the university.
And so in 1984, when you started studying climate, what were the big issues people were looking at then?
I think back then, we're probably concerned a lot about drought conditions. That was a big one because obviously it has widespread impacts not only in Illinois but around the world. And some of the others, they also looked at heavy rainfall events. And climate change was not discussed that much.
I was going to ask, when did you first start hearing a concern, or when did people start studying climate change?
Yeah, there were people studying it into the 1980s and before, but it was only a handful of people. I mean, you could probably fit all of the ones doing active research in one room up until that point. And it was really, we started to see an increased interest in that through the 1980s and 1990s, but I'd say it's really blossomed in about the last 10 to 15 years, where it's gone from being something in the future to something that we're seeing right now. I think that's the other big step, is that it's no longer about polar bears and what's going to happen in 2050. It's about what's happening right now.
And what's different about being the state climatologist as opposed to what maybe a more typical client climate scientist, the work they might do?
Yeah, so in my job, I have a lot more outreach effort than a regular regular climatologist, and that's part of the job. So I interact with state officials, do a lot of that, also with city officials and various stakeholders like farmers and engineers and city planners and stormwater management folks. So it's much more engaged than your typical climate scientist would be.
My guest is Jim Angel, Illinois State Climatologist. He's been telling us about his job. He's retiring this month after 21 years. You can call in and ask him a question. Our number is 1-800-222-9455. You can also tweet to 21STShow. We get to get a tweet from Josh in Chicago from the NRDC. Josh wrote us and asked, what is the biggest change you've noted from the National Climate Assessment that affects Illinois?
I think the biggest one that we've seen so far is the change in precipitation. So overall, wetter conditions and more of the heavy rain events. We've gotten about double the number of heavy rainfall events over the last century. So first half of the 20th century, not that big of a problem, and now it's a big problem. So almost every time I turn around, somebody's getting hammered by 2, 4, 6 inches of rain. And so that's the biggest one that impact we've seen so far in Illinois has been on the water side of things.
And Josh has a second part of this question. What potential future impacts on the land of Lincoln alarm you most that people aren't thinking about?
I think the big one that we've dodged so far is the increase in temperature. So far, we've gotten warmer. So especially, you notice in the wintertime.
And then I wonder, I was thinking about this yesterday. So I think the official temperature was probably 48 yesterday. Yeah. When I was driving back from Chicago, though, my car thermometer had it at 50. And so I was thinking, is this weird in December? This seems like it's weird, but maybe I'm just thinking that it's strange.
No, this is actually fairly warm for December, especially after that very cold November there that we flipped back like this. So that's kind of what we've seen. We see more winters where you're seeing 40, 50, 60 degree weather. It was a couple of years ago. Gosh, we were in February and it was like in short sleeve shirts. So that's an area that I'm really concerned about in the future. And not so much the winter side, but the summer side of things. So we really have not seen the heat like they've seen in California and other places. But if we warm up by about 4 to 5 degrees by mid-century, we're going to see a lot more really hot days. So, 95, 100-degree weather. That's going to be a lot more common for us than it is now.
So if you've got questions or comments for Jim, you can give us a call. Our phone number is 1-800-222-9455. That's 1-800-222-9455. We've actually got meteorologist Jeff Frame on the line here. Jeff also teaches atmospheric sciences at U of I. Hey, Jeff, welcome back to the 21st.
Hi, thanks. Calling in to wish Jim a happy retirement. Congratulations on that.
Thank you, Jeff.
Yeah, and not only are we going to miss you around the department and at the university, but our students are really going to miss you, too. One thing I remember is we've had several of our students go over and work with you on conducting climatologies or case studies over there at the Water Survey, and they've gotten their senior capstone research projects done that way.
You're getting big thumbs up from Jim here. So
yes,
thanks for
great.
That, Jeff. Jeff, do you have any questions for Jim?
Do I have any questions for Jim? Well, let me think. I'm sure I have a lot of questions. I'm not sure if anybody would want to hear them, but
I meant weather ones, but that's okay.
Yeah. Well, what are you going to do with your retirement?
Well, yeah, that's a good question. So I have two granddaughters, one 4 years old, one month old. So I'll definitely spend more time with them. And I'm not going to totally retire. I'll probably still do several things. I'm kind of looking into doing maybe some consulting work. There's a lot of need for climate and climate change work still, especially in the Chicago area. So I think there's a lot of opportunities there. So I'll be not really fully retiring, more kind of like slowing down for the next several
years. Yeah, well, that's a good way to be. Thanks, Jeff. That's Jeff Frame. Also, another Illinois meteorologist giving us a call to say goodbye to Jim Angel. You can give us a call, too, if you have questions for him as well. 1-800-222-9455. Jim, I wonder, to Jeff's point about students, have you seen an increase in students interested in going into this field now, especially I'm thinking even in the past 5 to 10 years? Are there more people who are interested in studying this and becoming scientists?
Yes, I think so. I think there's... In terms of the climate science, there's a lot more interest in it. And, you know, climate is more than just studying about historical records or talking about climate change. There's all kinds of things you can do with that in that field. So you can talk about climate policy and social science and climate and as well as run climate models. And so it has a full range of things that you can do. And so we've seen a lot of students with a lot of interest in that. You know, when I went to school the first time around, I had never heard of a climatologist before. I knew about thunderstorms and tornadoes and stuff like that, but climate change, I didn't know anything about that. So this,
right, so unfortunate, but also a whole generation of people who are learning to study this. We've got Eric Snodgrass on the line with us. Eric is the director of undergraduate studies. He's also in the Department of Atmospheric Sciences at U of I. Hey, Eric, welcome back to the 21st. What have you learned from Jim?
Oh, my gosh. What haven't I learned from Jim? Jim is, I'll tell you something. I get the chance to travel the country and talk with a lot of different people about weather and weather risk. And Jim has a national reputation, and it's amazing. So, I have two questions for you as you're getting ready to retire. One, who in the world is going to fill your shoes? I have no idea who that person is. And secondly, I got a lot of farmer friends that would like to know, what's your forecast for next July? If you have that, you can give it to me before you retire. I'll take it, okay?
Okay.
Thanks for that, Eric.
Yeah, thanks, Eric.
Yeah.
Yeah, if I knew the forecast for next summer, I would be retired and very rich.
When we think about that, though, when we think about technology, and I wonder how much when we're thinking about it, I'm thinking in particular about our supercomputing abilities, how much that's changed our ability to predict and forecast.
Yes, that has definitely made a big difference. And I think that's going to continue on into the future. We're going to rely a lot more on that and less on the woolly caterpillars and those kind of indicators. And yeah, it's something that we've really seen a major leap forward. So, you know, there's a lot of work with weather models, which are more short term, but the climate models there's a whole group of them that are being developed to look at the seasonal forecast. So what's going to happen this winter, next spring, next summer. And I think there are going to be some real breakthroughs in that as soon as they get some of the bugs worked out of it.
We're speaking with Jim Angel, Illinois State climatologist who's retiring at the end of the month. I wanted to play something for you, Jim. Senator Durbin was on the program last week, and we were actually talking about climate change. And I wanted to play an observation that he made for us.
Just a couple weeks ago, I sat down with a CEO of an Illinois-based property and casualty insurance company. Those of us who know the insurance industry a little bit know that they focus more on weather and weather patterns than almost anything, because that is their exposure to damages and costs in the future. And this gentleman was telling me his property and casualty company no longer writes insurance on the coast, either the West Coast or East Coast, because of the hurricanes and problems that they've had in those areas. And he said, we've got increasing problems here in the Midwest.
That's Senator Dick Durbin last week. And it relates to a question that we also got from another listener. Carlo Robicelli sent us a question. He works at Illinois Wesleyan. He also serves on McLean County's board. And he says that Illinois is poised to either benefit or suffer from climate change. And he wanted to know how policymakers in Illinois, both state and local, can be smart and figure out how to, quote, minimize the downsides and capitalize on the upsides.
Yeah, so those are good questions. It's interesting because it used to be, if you talk about climate change, you talked exclusively to climate scientists. Now you're talking to the insurance industry, ag producers, and so forth. So everybody's really tuned into that now.
And state and local governments are starting to see this. Right.
And I probably get more phone calls now from especially local governments, and not so much from the state yet. I think for whatever reason, that wasn't a high priority there for a while, but I suspect that'll change very soon. And certainly we've had some communities that have been really outstanding in getting in front of this. And that's where you want to be. You want to get in front of this before you're overwhelmed by heavy rains and heat waves and things like that. So, for example, the city of Chicago has been doing a lot of work over the years on this, in both planning for and adapting to climate change. So there's kind of multiple paths that you have to go through. One is reducing your risk of future climate change, but also reducing the greenhouse gas emissions as well. So
how do you think smaller, the city of Chicago has an enormous amount of resources to devote to this. So when we're thinking about cities across Illinois that don't have as much money as Chicago, how would you advise local governments to be researching this and being prepared for this?
Yeah, so I think one of the areas that I've worked with a lot of city governments with are things about heavy rainfall events. So we're updating the numbers for that as we speak. And so we'll get some new numbers on the 100-year storm and what that means. And so they can better plan for heavy rainfall events in the future. But it will unfortunately take a major investment in infrastructure to make this happen. So you got to build up the storm sewer system. You got to look at things like permeable pavers and green roofs and other kinds of green infrastructure to weather these kind of events.
And so do you think that cities, and we'll get to individuals after the break, but do you think cities really need to be thinking about how they're constructing buildings, how they are looking at even permitting for whether it's a municipal building or private construction? That's going to be an increasingly important part of how to combat this?
Yes, I think very much so. And I think the time to start that conversation is now, because if they haven't already, they should be talking about that. Regardless whether it's, a city of 5,000 or 50,000 or 500,000, we're all going to have to address these issues.
We're going to take a break. When we come back, we will wrap up our conversation with Jim Angel, our state climatologist who is retiring after 21 years. We've got a couple more questions from listeners that we will get to after the break. And if you want to call or tweet, keep tweeting to 21STShow. You can call 1-800-222-9455. Stay tuned. You're listening to The 21st.
Support for The 21st comes from Sock Club, delivering new designs of socks each month made with cotton grown and knit in the southeastern United States. Gift subscriptions are available this holiday season to keep friends and family in socks year-round. More information is available online at sockclub.com.
Listening to The 21st, I'm Nyla Boodoo. My guest is retiring state climatologist Jim Angel. We're taking your questions for him. Our phone number is 1-800-222-9455. That's 1-800-222-9455. Let's go to Nancy, who's just outside Rockford. Hi, Nancy. Welcome to The 21st. What's your question for Jim?
Good morning, Jim. I'm enjoying listening to you so much. I wanted to ask you, how do we in Illinois learn to adapt? I freeze to death. I have a little bit of a medical issue with my body temperature, and I wonder how I'm over 57 and a little past there. And I wondered, how do we learn to adapt? I have to bundle up in my home all the time, wear a winter coat inside my home, even though I have a very nice three-bedroom here in McChesney Park. How do we learn to adapt, Jim? And thank you.
Oh, thank you. Well, for adapting to climate is always a concern. Even back in the 1820s, when Illinois was first being explored, that was some of our earliest weather records were taken back then to figure out whether we could live here and grow crops and so forth. And I'd say, one of the challenges for Illinois is that we have a very variable climate. We live right in the middle of the continent, so we don't have the oceans to moderate our temperatures. So even though we talk about climate change and warming, we're still going to have to deal with cold winters and hot summers and droughts and floods and heat waves and all that good stuff. So as far as like your house goes, I'd say, beef up the insulation as best you can. I'm adding another layer on my house to make it even more effective to keep it both hot in the warm in the wintertime and cool in the summer.
Right, because an extra layer of insulation matters for regardless of how extreme the temperature is.
Exactly, yeah. So those are the kind of things you can adapt for. And I think probably in the future we're going to see increased sophistication on how we monitor heating and cooling conditions. You can do everything from your phone now. So there's there's going to be a lot of advances in those areas, too.
And to Carlo's point earlier, do you think he was, I'm wondering when he was asking from the government side how governments can maybe capitalize on climate change? I mean, we've talked about the downsides for Illinois, but there, in some ways, there's also some positives for our state.
That's right. Yeah. So for especially for Illinois, we are a water rich state. So compared to many states out west, we have plenty of water.
Not just Lake Michigan.
That's right. You know, we got Lake Michigan, fresh water. We also got the Illinois River, Mississippi, and the Ohio. We have the Mahomet Aquifer. We've got other rivers and streams that we're much better off in terms on the water side than many other states out west. So I suspect as we feel the pinch from rise in sea level and hotter conditions in the southwest, that we'll see actually a migration into the Midwest. There's actually been some studies that have looked at that. So we might actually get a boost in some respects from changing climate.
Jane from Dixon also wrote us with a question. She asks, do you monitor birds or insects using Doppler radar? If so, what trends have you noticed? And she also said, thank you for your many years of service.
Oh, thank you. So yes, we have. In fact, one of the first projects I worked on here at the Water Survey back in 1984 was we had an experimental radar that looked at bird migration, and you can pick them up. Not individual birds, but if you've got a sensitive radar and a close range, you can see flocks of birds. So you can see them coming and going. And even today, I have friends that in the meteorology field that share pictures of birds on Doppler radar. And strangely enough, you can get large insect whatever flocks they are, whatever you call those.
I guess I would think like a locust swarm or
or something like that, that you can actually see those on radar too. So you can track them. It's an interesting field. As far as the birds go in general, that's outside of my area of expertise. I do know that, obviously birds are sensitive to climate and weather, just like everybody else. And so I suspect they will be stressed during the climate conditions that we are expected to have.
So, Jim, I wanted to ask you, as you think back on this, the end of your official career, as you said, you're going to keep working. I have to say, I'm a little envious. You know, I love meteorology. I feel like if I was not a public radio host, I would love to work for the Weather Channel because I love weather so much. What have you liked the most about your job?
Well, I like actually talking to people about weather and climate. That's always fun. And you can share stories. You know, there's some fields like nuclear physics that maybe, you know, you can't talk to somebody in a restaurant about their views on that. But, you know, on weather and climate, everybody's got an opinion and everybody's got a story to tell. That's always the most fun part. So everybody remembers the tornado that hit their grandfather's farm or the big flood or the drought or something like that. So I'm always interested in those kinds of stories.
Do you feel like we pay more attention to weather now than we did when you first started in the 80s? I mean, you talked about, and I wonder if it just depends on who you are. Like you said, you know, you come from a farming family. Obviously, farmers have had to pay close attention to the weather. That's a huge part of their livelihood. But do you feel like among the general population, people are paying more attention or are more educated or informed about it now?
I think so to a degree. I think the advantages are probably the biggest jump forward has been the smartphone. You know, before that, you had to be sitting at a computer in your house or
now
in your
my phone
office.
Tells me when it's going to start raining.
Exactly.
You know, now my phone is like, it will start raining in 4 minutes.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. So you can look on the radar and so there's a lot more information available out there and right at your fingertips. So that's a big difference.
And do you think that's a good thing? That there's a lot more information out there?
Well, it can be if used with care. I think you still have to kind of understand the basics of weather to really get the full advantage of that.
That said, I wonder what advice you have for young, budding meteorologists and climate scientists.
Yeah, so, you know, obviously learn as much as you can about weather and climate even, and you can do it at any age. And that's one of the fun things about this field is you can go out there and set up a rain gauge and take daily observations and learn about all kinds of things about the weather and snowfall and rainfall and all that stuff right in your backyard. So you can even start at a very young age without too much investment in equipment. And, of course, then, you know, you take always the math and other things in school. But also we have a great Department of Atmospheric Science here at the university with undergraduate and graduate degree programs in climate and meteorology. So a great resource that you go all the way up into the field like I did.
And so for those of us who are not going to end up into your field, but are whether interested or just very concerned about the weather, I think it's really easy to hear climate change predictions. You and I have talked about this a lot, even when we're not on air, right? About how it, sometimes in a way it can be really overwhelming. You and I both have talked about the challenges we have of communicating about climate change. It's something we think a lot about in my field. Obviously, it's something you think about even more. How do you think we should be thinking about this? What advice do you have for people who are concerned about this but think this is such a big issue and think at an individual level, is there really anything I can do? This seems inevitable or...
Yeah, so that is a challenge of not getting overwhelmed. And I think, there is always hope that we can turn things around and we won't avoid all the climate change, but at least we can dampen some of the worst impacts. And some of it goes beyond just, winter coat or new air conditioner and stuff like that. There we can beef up things like our public health facilities so that people can deal with heat waves better. There's issues like that we can address. And a lot of those have immediate payoff. So, if you talk about heat and the stress from that, anything you can do right now is helpful and also prepares you for future climate change.
As we end, what do you want people in Illinois to know about their state's weather and climate? What do you think we're not thinking about enough or not talking about enough?
That's a good question. So I think the big concern is the extreme events. So we talk a lot about, average temperatures getting by 4 to 5 degrees warmer by mid-century and things like that. But it's really the extreme events, the heavy rainfall, the droughts, the heat waves there. It can be very challenging for us to deal with. And I think if history has been any indication, I think we're in for some real struggles ahead.
That's Jim Angel, who is our retiring state climatologist. We don't yet know who your replacement is, Jim, but I imagine that'll be someone you'll also be training. But I wanted to say thank you. I know we've had lots of folks who have said that to you already, but thanks for being here. And I know this isn't the last time you'll be on the 21st, but I guess this is the last time you'll be as a official state climatologist. So thanks for being with me. I appreciate it.
Oh, thank you. Thank you, everybody.
The University of Illinois has fired a tenured professor for just the second time since the 1960s. Fei Wong had been an associate professor at the U of I School of Molecular and Cellular Biology at the Urbana campus since 2005. But on Friday, trustees voted to remove him by a vote of 7-0. It was unanimous. He had faked research data on a federal grant to the National Institute of Health and the National Science Foundation. Meanwhile, documents obtained by WILL show that in another story that Lee Waldrop, who was head of undergraduate student services at the School of Architecture, stepped down last August, an internal report found that 8 students came forward and said that he sexually harassed them. Brian Moline is WILL's managing editor. He's with us in studio here in Urbana to update us on both of these stories. Hi, Brian. Welcome back. Good morning.
Thanks for having me.
And I guess I should make our disclaimer that we always do at the beginning that this station, WILL, that produces the 21st that you're based at, that I am employed by, we are University of Illinois employees, but we have editorial independence from the university.
That is correct.
This Wong case has actually been going on behind the scenes for a couple of years. I said it was a unanimous vote for the trustees. This is very unusual that a tenured professor would be fired, right?
Yeah, it does not happen often. I think the last time was in 2013 when a longtime engineering professor, Louis Wozniak, was dismissed by the university. But as you mentioned, very rare, and as you said, only the second time in 50 years.
So does that mean the evidence against him was pretty overwhelming?
It certainly appears so, Nyla. This case has gone on for about 5 years. Back in 2014, a colleague came forward and raised some concerns about Wong and his research. From there, it went through several university committees, finally was forwarded to the Board of Trustees from President Killeen just about 7 or 8 months ago. The board held its own closed-door hearing on the case last month, and then after that hearing, decided to go forward with dismissing Wong just last week.
And so he was dismissed for falsifying a grant application to NIH. What does that mean? What specifically did he falsify?
Well, the report says that Wong's individual offenses included submitting results from experiments that were never performed. He also presented images of mouse cells, claimed that they were human cells in these applications. So, yeah, some pretty serious stuff when you're talking about a scientific researcher here.
And did the university get the grant money? And so I wonder, does the university have to return it, or what happens in this situation?
Yes, looks like there was a total of $355,000 worth of grant money, according to university spokesman Tom Hardy. It wasn't clear whether that money has already been returned or whether it will be returned. But yes, that's the amount of money we're talking about here.
I mean, so these are very serious. He saying not just it's not just like he was fudging numbers. This is making things up, presenting mouse cells as human cells. What has Fei Wong said about this? Does he deny the allegations?
It's interesting, Nyla. There's really not much of a denial here. Wong's argument against being dismissed seems to be that he did not receive what he felt was due process in all of this. Also interesting, since this investigation has taken 5 years to come to a conclusion.
By university standards, it's probably pretty fast, right?
I guess so. Wong has filed a federal lawsuit. He filed that suit last month before...
Against the university?
Against the university. Mm. He filed that suit in Northern Illinois last month before the hearing on the 16th. He was trying to get an injunction to stop that hearing. The judge did not grant him that injunction. At last report, his attorney said that that lawsuit will still go forward. And again, he's not really denying much of anything here. According to the report from the university, one of the things that he said in a statement, he wrote, quote, "I deeply regret for the terrible mistakes associated with the NIH grant. I wish I could take them back," end quote.
Mm. So there's actually been two stories this past weekend related to U of I faculty and staff. The News Gazette and WILL reported on Sunday that Lee Waldrip, the former director of undergraduate student services at the School of Architecture, resigned last year after allegations of sexual harassment involving students. Brian, why is this information just coming out now?
Well, a couple of media organizations, ourselves and the News Gazette here in Champaign, filed Freedom of Information Act requests about reports like the one that ODEA would have compiled against Lee Waldrip. We received that report, that's why we got the story out now, is because we got that report via a Freedom of Information
Act. So basically, reporters, the reason we know about this is because of Freedom of Information Request Acts filed by WILL.
Yes, Christine Herman specifically. Mm.
And what has the university said and done in response to both of these very different cases?
Well, I think the Board of Trustees report really stands on its own as far as the Wong case goes.
And it's a very clear statement by the university.
It is. They're firing him for cause and really no wiggle room there. Waldrop's case is a little bit different because he resigned just before this report would have been released. So essentially, he left before any disciplinary action could be taken against him by the university. We're still waiting to hear from his current employer, the University of Tennessee at Knoxville, to see if they were aware of any of these complaints against Waldrip, if they plan on taking any action against him. Robin Kaler, university spokesperson, did issue a statement. We had asked, there's another professor here at the University of Illinois, Jay Kazin, who was also subject of some sexual harassment allegations. Investigators concluded in Kazin's case that his behavior was highly appropriate, did not rise to the level of a sexual misconduct violation. But in this case with Waldrop, they concluded,
highly inappropriate.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes. Highly inappropriate. Robin Kaler says, although Kazin's behavior was inappropriate, it didn't rise to that level. Waldrop's, on the other hand, was, quote, showed a pattern of touching and predatory behavior. So that's why they were going to take disciplinary action against him if he had not left the university.
That's WILL's managing editor, Brian Moline. I know WILL will continue to follow all of these stories coming out of U of I. Brian, thanks for being with me. I appreciate it.
You're welcome.
In other U of I news, the women's volleyball team faced off against Nebraska in the Final Four last Thursday. It was a heartbreaker for the Illini. They won the first two sets, but Nebraska rallied to take the next three and advance to the national championship. Still a great run for the Illinois team. Congratulations on making it to the Final Four. And we know the Chicago Bears in sports news also have advanced. Last night, the Bears beat the Green Bay Packers to clinch a spot in the playoffs for the first time in 8 years, and they won the NFC division title as well. Sorry to any Packers fans listening, but go Bears for that NFC North division title. They face the 49ers next Saturday. You're listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Thanks for tuning in. The end of the year is fast approaching us, and it's always filled with lists, naughty and nice. If you're like me, it's a chance to make note of what you want to catch up on during these upcoming cold months. The best music, the best movies, and today, the best books. We've gathered book lovers and experts to share what they think are the best books of 2018, and we'd love to hear from you. Whether you think a moving memoir, a good thriller, or a work of historical fiction was your favorite thing for you, what stood out? Give us a call at 1-800-222-9455, or you can share your picks on Facebook or Twitter at 21STShow. Joining us now are Darna Seaman, the editor of Booklist magazine, which is put out by the American Library Association. She's based in Chicago. Also on the line with us from Springfield is Dana Weber, a librarian at the Lincoln Library, the public library of Springfield. And Javier Ramirez is also with us from the Book Table Bookstore in Oak Park. All of you, welcome to the 21st. Good morning. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having
us. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
So we've got great lists here that you guys have put together. But I want to start by just asking all of you, Donna, let's start with you. How does 2018 compare to past years when we're thinking about the books that came out this year?
I would say this was a really strong year for fiction and that we're seeing a very positive trend in terms of diversity of authors. It's really been exciting to see so many new names, so many new perspectives. I've really noticed that.
Dina, what about you? What's one book that you would like to start with that is your favorite pick for the year?
I'm going to go ahead and start with My Sister, the Serial Killer, by Oyenkin Bryawetti.
What a great title.
Yes, I agree. And if you can take a look at the cover, it's also very, very killer. And I absolutely intend that pun.
So what is this about what it seems like it's about?
Yes, exactly. So this is a short, very punchy, sort of a hand grenade of a novel that follows a Nigerian woman whose younger sister has a very inconvenient habit of killing her boyfriends. And that pretty much sums it up. The main character, Karidi, is bitter because her sister, Ayula, is the favorite child. She's the beautiful one, and she is possibly sociopathic. And now Ayula's third boyfriend in a row is dead.
Oh,
and once again, Karidi is called in to help clean up the mess. Karidi knows the best solutions for cleaning blood. The trunk of her car is big enough for a body. And she keeps Ayula from posting pictures of her dinner to Instagram when she should be mourning her missing boyfriend. And we also find out that Karidi has long been in love with a kind and handsome doctor at the hospital where she works. And one day he asks Karidi for Ayula's phone number. So nothing good can come of that.
No, so okay, so we'll just leave it at that, right?
Yes, exactly.
So is this considered, would you say this is considered a thriller or a mystery? Or
I would say it's more of a thriller because the title has the answer to who is doing all of these killings right there. So it's interesting to watch and see how these two sisters navigate their relationship. And just how far is Karidi willing to go to defend her sister?
Okay. Javier Ramirez is also with us from the Book Table in Oak Park. Javier, when you think about this year, I wonder, are there specific genres that stand out to you as being most popular among the folks who are coming in to the Book Table this year?
You know, it seems like this every year, but
it's really hard, sort of the opposite of your question, and I think it'll fill it out, but it's hard to find something funny. So there's a lot of serious like fiction out there in a very good way. And I kind of wanted to piggyback on your question to Donna. I see a lot of small presses that are really busting out this year and really making their mark on just, you know, not staying local in their respective cities and breaking out and having more of an impact on the greater landscape. But I think like there's been a lot of serious heartfelt fiction this year, seems like more so than in past years.
Yeah. When we're thinking about, and you know, this isn't this year, but I know she re-released Samantha Irby, who was formerly based in Evanston, a very mm-hmm. funny writer, but I think she re-released Meaty this year because she's working on a new television series that's coming out, I think, maybe next year. I wonder how popular, I'm thinking, Sam's books are for you at the book table, Javier.
I was pretty surprised. As Oak Park is a pretty progressive, older crowd, and we sold a lot of media. I was really surprised by that.
It's very funny. I think she's a very funny person, and she's a very even funnier writer. So,
she's
a local Illinois. Well, I'm going to call her local Illinois, even though I know she's not. She doesn't live in Illinois anymore. Javier, what's the first book on your list that you wanted to recommend for this year?
My first book is called Who is Vera Kelly by Rosalie Knecht. It's from Tin House, and it's this really wonderful slow burn Cold War spy fiction with a neat twist. It's told from the perspective of a young woman who has been recruited by the CIA to infiltrate a group of students supporting a military coup in Buenos Aires, and told from the perspective of a woman. Women are rarely in spy fiction. If they are, they're the femme fatale. But I think that Rosalie really, really like brought this home. It's dual narratives. It's told in flashback from 1957 when she lives in Maryland with her mother, coming from a troubled home, and sort of works up to her being recruited. You know, between there, sort of finding herself sexually, she in underground clubs in New York and as a closeted lesbian, and so the whole genre is like I said has been skewed towards men, but this is just a really wonderful book about, because Cold War spy fiction is one of my favorites. And
oh yeah, it's a really unusual perspective. To Donna's point about the diversity, it sounds like that's a really good pick from that front. Donna, I wonder for you, if you're thinking, we've been doing thrillers and we've been doing fiction, I wonder if you're thinking about your favorite nonfiction book of the year, what's at the top of your list?
Oh, I'd love to talk about nonfiction. You know, I have many books that I really love, but I find myself thinking a lot about a Chicago-connected work. It's a biography/memoir called Looking for Lorraine, The Radiant and Radical Life of Lorraine Hansberry, which people will know as the author of the play A Raisin in the Sun. Hansberry was a very private person, but she lived an extraordinarily complicated life. She was a great activist. She was secretly gay. She wrote sort of feminist lesbian novels under a pen name. And author Amani Perry does a beautiful job of tracking down all the kind of secret aspects of Hansberry's sadly short life, but very full. And this book brings up so many interesting perspectives on the civil rights movement and the black arts movement. Hansberry grew up in Chicago, but also lived in New York and was very close with James Baldwin and a bunch of other fascinating people. So this is a real surprise of a book. It's published by Beacon, and I highly recommend it.
Remind us of that title name again, Donna, for people who are specifically
looking for Illinois books. Looking for Lorraine, The Radiant and Radical Life of Lorraine Hansberry.
Oh, Dana, I don't know about you. I think people tend to either veer towards fiction or nonfiction. Do you have a favorite fiction or nonfiction next on your list you want to share with us?
Oh, I'd love to. Thank you. Yes, I love both. I feel like I'd like to be the historical fiction person this morning and talk about a tremendous novel by Rose Ellen Brown, who's had many books in the past, Before and After, Civil Wars, Tender Mercies. Rose Ellen's lived in Chicago for a long time, and her new novel is The Lake on Fire. And it begins with a Jewish family who's fled the violent pogroms in Russia, and they're living in Wisconsin. But one of the daughters and a younger brother runs away to Chicago, and this is during the World's Columbian Exposition of 1893. The White City, this is a Gilded Age novel, really a tale of two cities, because these two immigrant kids find themselves in both the poorest of the poor in the city and sort of infiltrating the elite. And the novel has some historical figures, including Jane Addams, and a tremendous perspective on the Columbian Exposition itself, which is such a lively setting. And it's just full of surprises and quite dramatic, and the characters are really interesting. It's a very compassionate and sensitive and entertaining novel. That's The Lake on Fire. It's from Saraband Press, one of the small presses that Javier mentioned.
Oh, great. So that's two picks from Donna Seaman, who's the editor of Booklist Magazine with the American Library Association. Dana Weber's also with us from Springfield, where she's a reference librarian at the Lincoln Library. Dana, I was interested to see that you had a graphic novel as one of your favorites of 2018. Can you tell us that book?
Sure. So this one is called Infidel, which is written by, I apologize if I'm pronouncing this incorrectly, but it's written by Pornsek Pichetschot, and the art is by Aaron Campbell. And this is a horror comic that has been published in single issues throughout the year, but the story is finished now, and it's bound together in one issue. And I highly recommend it if you love horror books or horror movies, but especially if you enjoyed Get Out, because it really builds off of that same type of modern horror and has characters that you don't always see in the horror genre.
Oh, interesting.
So it follows the story of Aisha, who is an American Muslim woman who lives in a building that was damaged by a bomber who happened to be Muslim, or rather, he's the alleged bomber, and the internet, the news media, all the residents of the building, they want to boil it down to that simple story. They don't want to question it. They don't want to confront it. They just want to settle back into their comfortable, closed world, and they really just don't want to examine any of the details about anything that happened with this bombing. And it is this denial, ignorance, and fear, which makes conditions perfect for raising a monster.
Hmm.
Because it wouldn't really be a horror story if the building wasn't haunted. But what makes this story a little bit different is that the entities that haunt this building feed off of the racism and xenophobia of all the other residents in the building, and they want to do harm to all of the people of color.
Wow, that sounds like there's a lot in there. Javier, I wonder if we're almost out of time, but I wonder, you had a YA book that also made your list, but I know we've got all of these lists from everyone, so we're going to make sure that everybody's list we will put at our website at 21stshow.org. Javier, do you want to talk about the YA fantasy, or is there another book from your list you want to pick out to highlight?
I don't remember having a YA title, but I can talk about them for sure.
Oh, I said it was Northwood. Was the list I had as a pick for
you?
Oh
no, Northwood is it's an adult novel, but it's fantastic.
Oh, it's not. Oh, whoops. Okay, sorry about that. But it's let's talk about Northwood.
Okay. So Maurice Meyer, who lives here in Chicago, in Hyde Park, she was one of my favorite writers writing today. She had a collection come out a couple years ago from FSG called The Heartbreaker, which set me on the path to basically read anything she writes. But she has come up with this beautiful, gorgeous, as a piece, the packaging for Northwood is amazing. It's a red hardcover, no jacket, with black pages and white print. So it's told in sort of, it looks like poetry, but it's actually a novel, told in these sort of fragmented stanzas about a young woman who has gone to live in a cabin in the woods to sort of create some art, and she takes up with a very kind of dangerous married man, and it's about her experiencing all of this and then looking back on her life as a married woman. I've read some reviews have called it sort of a fractured fairy tale, and I think it sort of has that feel to it. It's just some of the pages are, you know, maybe 8 or 10 words, and on the start, you know, the stark white and black background, it sort of lenses, you sort of fall into the book.
In a
very wonderful way. So
that's Northwood. I want to thank Javier Ramirez, who you're just listening to from the book table in Oak Park. Javier's got a couple of books here. We will keep that at our website. Dana Weber from the Lincoln Library, we have her list. And Donna Seaman from Booklist Magazine, they've got some great resources and lists online. And we've got some picks from Donna as well. If you want to share your favorite best book of 2018, and one of our listeners, Nanette, posted on Facebook saying The Great Believers was her favorite book of 2018. It's one of her all-time favorites. You can keep the conversation going online on Twitter about your favorite books. Thanks, the three of you, for being with me. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Coming up on tomorrow's program, the federal government has found that State Farm Bank mishandled the credit reports of some of its customers, for example, triggering credit inquiries when that person hadn't applied for a loan. Consumer advocates aren't happy. They say the government hasn't come down hard enough on State Farm. Tune in tomorrow for that. As I've mentioned a couple of times, our website, 21stShow.org, is a great resource to find past shows, more information about all of us. We are a production of Illinois Public Media, and I'm Nyla Boodoo. Thanks for listening. See you back here tomorrow.